back to the Parrot Podcast. I'm your host, Sandra, from Poodles and Parrots. Today, we are going to be talking with the famous Parrot Wizard, and I'm so excited. He's got a whole range of different parrots, including a Senegal, a Cape Parrot, a Macaw, and he's worked with African Greys, amongst many others. He's very knowledgeable in all parrots, and that's why his YouTube channel is called All Parrots. And you probably know him from social media and spreading all of his knowledge and education about parrots. So today we're going to jump in and we're going to chat with the great Parrot Wizard.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great, great. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to join me today. Let's just jump right into it. I'm so excited to chat with you, and I'm so excited to have you on the Parrot Podcast, the famous Parrot Wizard. So tell me a little bit about your background and what you do.
Well, my background is that I've been a parrot educator for a long time. I started out with training my own pet parrots just to be able to bond with them and do things. And what I've discovered is not only that I have a knack for teaching my birds, but I can teach other people how to achieve similar results with their birds. So hopefully I can be more than just a role model, but also an educator, help people develop a magical hands-on relationship with their bird. And it's not really just about training. It's actually, I really am much more about teaching a lifestyle about how to live in harmony with your pet parrot so that you can have a mutual respect and bond that really flows both ways. Where on one hand, the parrot is a little bit more well-behaved, more of the pet qualities that we're looking for, but also where we can be better stewards to our parrots and give them a better life in our home.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually love that you mentioned harmony, because I think that this is what a lot of parrot owners struggle with is living in harmony with their parrots. Because I get this comment all of the time, like, my bird is mean to me, my bird is biting, or my bird isn't any fun, or my bird's always screaming. And I think that what I love about your channel, and I've been following you for a really long time, I used to watch all of the Parrot Wizard videos, is that you share a lot of that education and expertise with people to really understand their parrots and why they do what they do, why they're noisy, why they're biting, and how to handle your parrot, but also to build trust. So before we get to all of the good stuff and the trust building and all those other things, can you tell everybody who's listening about your parrots, their names, their species, and their ages?
Yeah, sure. So I've got four parrots of mine at the moment. Kili, my Senegal parrot, is coming up on 15 years old. Truman Cape parrot, 13, and Rachel Lungle Macaw is 11. And also Cody, the Cape Parrot's the new addition to the flock. We just really have an affinity, my wife and I, for the Bucephalus genus and, of course, the Macaw. The Macaw I inherited through marriage. She was an adult parrot when I first met my wife. And, you know, through training and just relationship and bond building, I've been able to inherit her trust. And of course, my wife was able to befriend the parrots I previously had also because they were so well-trained and socialized. And that's the experience and relationship I'm hoping to share with all of you so that you can also find that harmony with your parrot. Also, the other thing that you mentioned about harmony, the incredible thing is that as we make their lives better, as we can be better understanding of them and help them feel more comfortable in our home with around us and things like that, the better they're going to behave with us. Usually a lot of those things like biting and, you know, where the parrot is exhibiting undesirable behavior, usually it's because they're not fitting in. They're not having all their needs met, you know, chewing up the furniture or biting. It's because their needs aren't met. They're scared. They don't have enough things to chew on. So as we improve their lifestyle and better tailor our home and our relationship with them, the nicer they are back to us as well. So giving, you know, you got to give before you can ask or receive. And that's definitely a big part of it.
You mentioned improving their lifestyle. For anybody that's listening, can you give a couple of tips of what you mean by that? Like, what can someone do to improve the lifestyle for their bird?
Absolutely. And the reason I like to talk about lifestyle is much more it's much broader than training. Most of us don't set out to become a pair trainer and have to, teach them and train them all in our home. Training is definitely a part of the lifestyle, but I like to look at it from a much broader perspective, everything from what we feed them, how much we feed, when we feed, their sleep schedule, the interaction with us, how often they see us, how much time they spend with us, how much time they spend not with us, providing an abundance of toys and better get enrichment. Just because there's a toy doesn't necessarily mean they're getting the experience out of it. So even like focusing on the quality of toys, stands, different places that they can spend time with us around the house. All of these different things play into that lifestyle. And when we open our, not just our hearts, but also our home to our parents and kind of adjust our interaction with them, as well as the things we use around the house with them, that forms the lifestyle. And we fall into the lifestyle of being parrot keepers and having parrots in our home. And before you know it, it's much more mutual and it works in both directions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is something that I talk about a lot, because when you're bringing a parrot into your home, they're not really domesticated pets, right? Like, they haven't been around as pets as long as like dogs or cats. So we have to always be mindful of the fact that we're bringing the wild into our home. And there's a lot of things that we need to change and adjust, even like with our own lifestyles. We need to get rid of Teflon and candles and chemicals and all these other different things. But we also need to incorporate like tree stands and a healthy diet and incorporating all of these things, enrichment and foraging opportunities to ensure that they're happy. You mentioned sleep, feeding, and socializing. So can you tell us, when it comes to sleep, how much should a parrot be sleeping, and what is, a good environment for them to be in when it comes to sleep?
When it comes to sleep, the sleep is never going to make them behave and make them be friends with you and all that kind of stuff, but not the right amount of sleep is going to be the thing that's going to set you back. So it's not that sleep builds the relationship, but the inadequate quantity of sleep can mess things up. So it's a quick way to start removing some of the things that are causing us trouble. And parrots, they're equatorial birds, so they need a much more equatorial duration of sleep, which is longer than what we usually have as humans and as Northern Hemisphere residents. We inevitably don't tend to give them enough sleep. So more will definitely be more favorable for most people. The other thing is about consistency. You really want to be consistent with the sleep schedule. You really want to have a sleep schedule. The consistency is almost more important than the duration. When it's a kind of a hodgepodge, different, a little different each day, that messes with their cycle. So being meticulous, put a reminder, put an alarm on your phone, or put your lights on timers so that it's the same all the time. You can be much more consistent and not be messing them up with the inconsistency that's just prone from our human way of about things.
Yeah, like as humans, like we can, it depends on the person, right? Like we can have 6 or 7 hours or 8 or 9 hours, but with parrots, they need like 12 hours of dark, quiet, uninterrupted time for their sleep so that they can, function at their best. Whereas like for me, I need like my 8 hours, but I know that Mia needs her 12 hours. And I like that you mentioned to set a timer, especially in the beginning when you first get your bird and this is something new to you and you're trying to get into a routine. Like now I've gotten into a routine. So as soon as I see that it's like 9 o'clock, I know that it's time for Mia to go to bed because our routine is 9 to 9. What is your routine like for your birds when it comes to sleep?
Mine's about like that too. I think it's 9:30 to 9:30, but a very important thing is not to listen to them, because it's like listening to a toddler, that they want to go to bed or don't want to go to bed. If you listen to them and you let them pick their own schedule, they're going to not get enough sleep and they're going to be groggy and they're going to misbehave and have trouble from that. So the big mistake would be to, in that, at least in the sense of sleep, is to treat them like an adult and say, oh, I'll let you go to bed when you get tired. Well, they're ready to stay up way more than they should. But then the next day they're going to be groggy and misbehaving. So be consistent, use your timer, use your logic about setting the sleep schedule rather than letting them pick it. And that includes covering the cage at night or blacking out the room, because they'll inevitably wake up way too early, and that's going to end up messing up the sleep schedule. They'll be vocalizing and calling and screaming at 6 in the morning, waking you up and your neighbors, and those kind of things end up making people fed up with them eventually, and not be able to keep them for the long run. So alleviating some of the problems with supplies, you know, and timers and, you know, things you can use physical, covering the cage or putting the light on a time or any of those kind of things, makes less frustration for you and a much more manageable relationship, while also providing them a more natural environment. It's actually not more natural to just leave the windows open, uncovered, and let them wake up when the sun comes up, because we've taken them, displaced them from equatorial climates and put them in the northern hemisphere. And when the sun's only up for 8 hours in the day and it gets dark much sooner, or it's summer and we got 16 hours of daylight, that's not natural for them. So in fact, the artificial way is to help bring it back to their nature rather than away from it. So the more natural solution isn't necessarily always the more natural for them.
Yeah. And I always recommend to people like to have like those blackout curtains, or some people can cover their birds. And there are lots of different cage covers, but I know that the cage covers can also stimulate hormones, and it's not always recommended, but I wanted to get your take on it. What do you think about cage covering at night?
I don't think cage covering is the thing that stimulates the hormones. I think it's the tightness and proximity. So if the cage is reasonably big and you're broadly covering the full cage and it's night and they're sleeping, it's not the thing. It's more like those happy huts. It's more like maybe putting them in a carrier or a sleep cage at night, like some very small, tight place, and making it dark, or putting them, covering the cage in the daytime. It's those types of things that are more hormonal inducing, rather than covering the cage and just making it pitch dark for 12 hours and then uncovering it.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I personally find that covering Mia's cage makes it a lot better for her to have that darkness and stay quiet in the mornings, but I don't cover it all the way. Like, she has a gap around the bottom, and the back is, or like her cage is to the wall. And we also have like the blackout blinds in the room just to keep that darkness, so she's not waking up at 6 in the morning and screaming. But
yeah,
luckily she doesn't
idea.
Do that. I also wanted to ask you, since we're talking about light and sleep, and because we've taken them out of their natural habitat and we have them in our homes, what do you think about using a UV, like the bird UV lamps? Like,
it's
do you
snake
recommend
oil.
those?
They don't work.
They don't work?
I would. In theory, it's a great idea. In reality, they don't work.
Oh, really? Even the Arcadia ones?
I'm not sure.
Because those ones are like
brand
bird
basis.
Lamp specific. And so from my understanding, having them on during the day, especially during the winter when they're not able to get as much sunlight, has been recommended by a lot of
It's a good idea, but I've consulted with some people who've done extensive testing with UV meters and things like that. And it turns out that taking the bird outside in winter, protected with a harness or a cage on a cloudy day, is going to get them more UV than those bulbs give them. It turns out that putting the cage by the window with some sunlight through the window is going to give them more UV than those bulbs do. The bulbs expire much faster than they burn out. So even if they are a legit bulb, the UV output might only last a few months, whereas the bulb might last a few years. So you might be misled that it's doing something when it's not. The distance and proximity of the bulb to the bird matters. And a lot of the bulbs are manufactured in China and of subpar quality. And a lot of the bulbs don't even emit the UV that they claim they do. And even the better ones that maybe do, there's a lot of issues like the distance and the longevity of them and things like this. So there's a lot of misconception. I feel that the bulbs mislead people into a false sense of security. So my recommendation is just to use the natural sun as much as possible, whether it's to take your bird outside on the warmest days in the winter briefly, or putting the cage by the window sometimes and things like this, because that actually works. And we see the results in the birds and on the UV meters, but we don't see the results with the bulbs. So I'm not a fan of them.
Interesting. I had no idea. That's really great information. When it comes to putting like your bird's cage by the window, I've also read a lot that because of the way that the windows are made nowadays, you're not getting those UVs through the window. Is that true?
That's true. You're not getting much. You're not getting much, but if they spend a long period of time by that window, they're going to get something, and it's going to be more than putting their cage in the middle of the room, you know, far from the windows in a dark corner, things like that. And yeah, it's going to be more than those UV bulbs. So it's not the best. It's not everything, but of course it's too cold. You can't put them outside. It's still going to be better than nothing.
Okay. Interesting. Wow. Thank you for sharing that.
I have some anecdotal evidence of some of those things over the years where I have been noticing some physical differences in the birds when we give them the extra access to light versus when we don't. There's some things about them that are a little different that you can see and smell on them. Very subtle, but I have over the years seen that. Whereas when I've used the bulbs, or for people who have used the bulbs, I've met their birds, I don't see the effects of UV on those bulbs. Very anecdotal. That's not scientific. I have talked to people who've done the metering with the UV meters and things like that. That's a little bit more scientific, but everything seems to point that it can't be natural sunlight.
Oh my gosh, I'm so surprised. I had no idea. I thought that the bird-specific lamps were really beneficial, and I didn't know. So
in theory,
everybody, you heard
are.
It here
everything
first from the Parrot Wizard.
Would say so. Everything you read about them would say so, but when it comes to actual results, between measuring the UV output and them not performing the way expected, and you know, the results just don't seem to add up. I'm a fan of them in theory. I think it's a great idea. I wish they would make them better so that it would actually work, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
Gotcha. Okay. Since we're on this topic, I want to jump into taking your bird outdoors. And I know that you talk a lot about harness training, and your birds are harness trained. And in a few of your videos, you've also mentioned that it's the highest level of training when it comes to having a parrot. Now, I actually got Mia an aviator harness, but when I was ordering it from the store, they told me to get an extra, extra, extra small. And I actually think that it's too small, because I wasn't able to notice that until I opened it, because I don't think that this is going to fit around her. Sorry, Mia. I don't think that this would fit around her head. This is really small. And for a green cheek conure, I think I should have gone a size up. But this seems like it would be like for a budgie. But I don't know. I need to reorder her, I think, a different one. But can you tell us a little bit about the benefits of taking your bird outside with a harness and the steps that it takes to harness train your bird?
Well, absolutely. Taking the bird outside, fresh air, sunlight, socialization. Absolutely. All these things are very beneficial. It also really improves your bird's relationship with you. They bond with you in a whole other way, because now you're going on adventures and endeavors together. You're experiencing slightly scary, unusual, unfamiliar things, and they look to you for guidance and bonding and reassurance and safety. And you build a relationship that goes beyond anything that you can create at home, where it's their territory, they're comfortable, you know, everything's more routine. So breaking that routine is kind of the higher level. It's not the thing you start out with. You're not going to build a better relationship by taking the bird outside when you don't even have things figured out at home. But when things are going great at home, you got it figured out. You can take it to the next level by being able to take the bird outside with you. Now, teaching the bird with the harness is one of the most complicated and difficult tasks in any of parrot training. So before you get to that, or on the road to that, don't feel pressured to just stick the bird in a harness and just force them outside, because if they're not happy wearing the harness, they're not going to be happy outside. None of those benefits are going to add up for you. So instead, use a travel cage. You can take the bird outside to get at least 3/4 of all the benefits of the harness just by using a travel cage. The bird's going to get the fresh air, the sunlight, and a little bit of social interaction and, you know, seeing different things. And the element that the harness adds on top of that is the mobility and the one-on-one interaction. That the bird's on your hand, the bird's looking at you, talking to you, looking to you for safety, and the bird's able to possibly move around, walk around on something, fly around a little bit. So those aspects are kind of the cherry on top, and it's quite a bit of work to get to there, but it's the ultimate relationship and experience with the parrot.
Yeah, and with the sunlight, what are the benefits of birds getting sunlight? I mean, they're getting vitamin D. They're getting, I think, calcium. Plus, it's really great for their feathers.
Exactly. Take a parrot outside in direct sunlight, even in a cage for 15 minutes. Take that bird home and smell that bird, and they're glowing. They smell fresh and clean. I think it also it nukes the bacteria or anything on the surface of the feathers. They just come back glowing. They smell good. I think they feel good. And after all, even prisoners get an hour of sunlight a day as a basic human right. So I feel that it's our responsibility as carers to take those birds outside whenever possible. Again, you don't have to do the harness. Don't take it too far. Don't take a bird outside unrestrained. Even with clipped wings, they can fly away. So don't
Yeah.
rely on anything but a travel cage, aviary, or harness, take a bird outside. But I think every pet owner can improve their health and relationship by building that into their routine, that whenever the weather's good, whenever it's possible to do that. The harness is the funnest way, but it's also the hardest way. So use an aviary, a travel cage until you're ready, but the health benefits to them will be almost immediate.
Yeah. And you don't have to necessarily take them out every single day, but whenever you have the chance or the opportunity or you've got good weather. Obviously, in the winter, we can get out a little bit less if you live somewhere with four seasons. But spring, summer, and fall, you can usually take them out a lot more often than in the winter. How many times a week would you recommend to take out a bird if the weather is good?
It's really up to the owner. I mean, as much as possible. I think for the bird, even daily is great. Like, there's no amount that's too much for the bird. If the weather's good, if the temperature's comfortable, it can't be too much. They're outdoor animals. They're
Yeah.
that's obvious. But I think once a week or every other week, if at a minimum, if it's difficult for you to take them out more than that, I think an hour a week. You can do more than any UV bulb.
Really? That's amazing. I love that. And I love that you're sharing this. And that's it. Mia, we're going outside whenever it's
And
sunny.
again, back to my skepticism about the UV bulbs, the simple fact is that we can see, smell, experience the results of them going outside in natural sunlight, and it's tangible. Like, just try it. And then if you have a good enough relationship where you can get up close to the bird and give them a sniff, smell their feathers, just look at their feathers, look at how they look. It's just different after going outside, and I haven't seen that result from anything else.
I just saw Rachel take a nice big poop.
Sure.
I love sniffing parrots. I think that like parrots smell so amazing and they're probably like one of my favorite smells. And so, yeah, like when they smell good, those are all good signs, I think, of their health, right?
Yeah, now, you know what though? After you take them outside for a little bit in direct sunlight, they smell like just really like fresh laundry, crisp bed sheets. Like they just
Oh
you
my
don't have to add any
gosh.
downy to them.
Amazing. Back to the harness training. Can you share your tips on like how to get your bird comfortable with a harness? I always see your videos where you hold up the harness and your birds just put their head through and then they let you put each wing through and then you adjust it. And I know that it takes a lot to get your bird to that point, and every bird's going to be different. For some birds, you might be able to train them in a month. For others, it might take 6 months or a year. It just, I think, depends on the bird. But what are your tips on getting your bird comfortable with the harness and getting them to that point where they come over and put their head through without, freaking out? Because I think that a concern that a lot of people have with harness training is trying to get it on, or you get it on over their head and then they start to freak out and they get entangled in all of it. And that, I think, is just like such a fear and nightmare for so many people.
Absolutely. And honestly, if there's only one thing I can share about the success with harness training is literally to forget about the harness. Everyone focuses on the harness. Everyone is goal-oriented. I have this harness. You just showed me. You have the package in your hand. I've got it. What am I going to do to get that harness on this bird? And that's the number one thing that leads people to failure is thinking every single thought you have about the harness is misleading you off of the real problem. The real problem has nothing to do with the harness. The real problem is that these parrots are an undomesticated wild animal, And they're not comfortable with all the things that you have to do. You, the human, has to do in order to put that harness on. Put that harness on. You need to have your hands close to the bird. You need to have your hands on the bird's head and neck while you're helping that harness go on. You're going to need to be able to open the wings to maneuver them into the harness. Your hands are going to be all over that parrot in that process. Most parrots wouldn't let you do that, but if you didn't have a harness, you wouldn't think of grabbing them by the wings and, maneuvering around their head and, touching them in such proximity. So the harness is just one level beyond that. So in reality, my biggest advice is to forget about the harness, focus on all the basic taming and training, build a inertia of success with basics, practice things like step up, targeting, and all the taming exercises to let you touch and handle them. And with that, the harness is just one more step. Instead of being everything, it's just taking it one step further, where instead of doing this with my hands, I'm going to do this with the piece of fabric and my hands to you. So then it's not such a big step anymore. So that's by far the biggest focus, is that people get so focused on the harness, so focused on what tips and tricks can I use on with the harness itself, that they forget that they need to actually prepare the bird before they're ready to even start that.
So your biggest tip, I guess the takeaway here is to get your bird really comfortable with handling them, putting your hands over their head, over their neck, stretching out their wings, and just that like husbandry of being able to handle each part of their body and getting them comfortable with that.
Exactly. And being methodical about it, doing in a repeatable way, doing in a deliberate and clear way, not just casually playing with them, which it definitely helps, definitely more trust. Doing it in a deliberate and methodical way, because then when you do it with the harness, you do the same things, but now you're just adding the fact that there's a harness in your hand while you're doing it. So that's the main gist of it. There's more to it. I have a whole step-by-step technique of how to actually work each step. And I have a DVD, and it's available for streaming on my website, very specific how to do the actual exercises. But those exercises are the icing on the cake. You really just want to have that trust first, that you're going to base that on.
And since you mentioned your website, for everybody who's listening, can you let us know how they can find you on social media and your website where they can stream that?
Absolutely. So you can follow us on the All Parrots YouTube channel at All Parrots on YouTube, Trained Parrot on Facebook, Trained Parrot on Instagram. And of course, you could see all my videos, supplies, articles, tips and information, and things that just help you have a harmonious relationship with your parrot on parrotwizard.com. I've got things like training perches, my book, The Parrot Wizard's Guide to Well-Behaved Parrots, the harness streaming video that goes step by step exactly how to do that. Parrot Academy with very in-depth premium videos on very specific training exercises and ways you can improve your relationship. And things like enrichment toys and other supplies that just bring that out. Everything on my website has always been developed where with the relationship in mind. I don't think I sell a single toy or item that isn't in some way to help you improve your relationship. Like I don't sell knickknacks or have anything that's kind of unrelated. It's all about things that, by giving that to your parrot, by giving a toy of that type to your parrot, by, weighing your parrot with a scale or any of these items, by having your parrot on a tree stand in your room, it all helps to build a bond relationship with your parrot. And that's the main theme of my website, parrotwizard.com, and just all my videos and the information I share is really about building that mutual bond and trust with a parrot of any species and any age. That's very important too. It's not just about, you don't have to go and get a baby parrot. You can get a parrot from a rescue. You can get an adult. You can inherit a parrot. You can build bond with your wife's parrot. You can bond with your husband's parrot. It doesn't have to be, there, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to get a baby to have that parrot be yours. It's about what you do with the parrot in the present and in the future that makes that parrot be yours, not, what age you got it at.
Yeah, absolutely. Since we're talking about it, And I know that you've chatted about this on your YouTube channel as well. What are your recommendations for anybody who's adopting a parrot or rescuing a parrot or inherited a parrot and it's an adult, and or even if it's a baby, like what are your tips for, like, what are the first things to do to build that trust and make sure that they're healthy and make sure that they're happy?
Absolutely. Well, whenever you bring a parrot home, I always recommend that you have the bird seen by an avian veterinarian. That's both to get an external but also an internal look in the bird. They can do things like blood work. They can do an X-ray if needed. They can see things inside the bird that you can't see with your own eyes. So to keep that bird healthy plus the rest of your flock healthy, I always recommend a quarantine and a vet visit. And then from there, it's the rest is on you. So I definitely recommend having the right supplies. Parrot training and building a relationship with a parrot is a lot of work. It's a lot of work. It takes weeks, months, years. It does not happen instantly. And anything you can shortcut by spending some money to buy a supply, buying a clicker and target stick, buying a training perch, buying a scale to weigh them, buying a bed sheet to cover the cage with, anything you can use money for. It shortcuts you for on the effort related, time related relationship building by a lot. And really, they come hand in hand. One doesn't replace the other. You still need to put in the time. You still need the supplies to help you in the process. But when you have the right stuff to do it with, it just makes it go smoother, makes it make more sound.
Easier.
The parrot has a tree stand. The parrot's going to land on the tree stand instead of landing on your curtains and on your TV. Like by giving
Yeah.
them the things that they like and enjoy better than your human stuff, you're going to protect your human stuff and you're going to get better behavior and better bonds. So the first thing is the vet. The second thing is the supplies. The third thing is the knowledge and information. What I really want to caution people is that parrots are not like dogs. They're not like any other pet. They really are just so different. They're highly intelligent. They fly. Even if they're clipped, they still have a brain that's developed for flight. So even if they cannot physically fly, even if they're older or disabled or something, they still think in a different way than any of those terrestrial pets that you're ever used to. And so being a bird makes them quite different. Another thing that's extremely misleading about parrots is that they talk, and we relate to them so much more and in so much more of a human way than with any other pet. When it comes to most other pets, we kind of see them as an animal. They run around on the floor. Like we see them in that pet aspect. When a parrot starts talking to you, and having grace starts talking to you in full sentences, and the parrot says, "I'm hungry. I'm hungry. You want banana?" When they start really, really talking to you, you treat them so
Flabbergasted.
much. It's just you treat them so different, and it's good and it's definitely a fun part of it, but it's easy to get carried away and take it too far and forget that they're still a bird with bird needs rather than, a human or a baby or a dog. So, really learning about them as parrots and treating them as parrots will give you much better success than kind of trying to carry over experience from raising children or raising other pets. The last one is to really give them time and space. We get really excited. We bring a new pet home, whether it's that adopted bird or a baby bird, and we want to get our hands on them. We want to interact with them. We want to do stuff with them. And cannot forget they are prey animals. They're naturally prey animals. That means they get eaten in the wild. They don't go eat others in the wild. They get eaten. And that's quite different than cats and dogs and other. Most pets are usually predators. I mean, they eat meat, even though they're not actually attacking or chasing anyone anymore as a domestic pet. They're still carnivores, so their mindset's quite different. They're not constantly looking over their shoulder and worried about everything. Parrots, they tend to be very reclusive, very in their shell, especially those older birds. If they had any mishandling in their previous home, if the previous owner just didn't handle them the right way, just being older and more mature, all those things are going to make them much more safety-minded and concerned and scared. And the absolute best thing that you can do is keep your hands to yourself, give them space, and then use positive reinforcement training and your supplies to gradually build up the things you want to do. Don't take a single thing for granted. Don't take for granted that they step up. Don't take for granted that they talk. Don't take for granted that they're going to let you touch them. They might, but chances are they won't. And chances are that even if they let you do some of those things, you're going to sooner or later inevitably push their boundaries too far, and you're going to make them uncomfortable. And they're going to let you know that by flying away or biting you, or losing their trust in you. So instead of ever reaching that boundary, which you're not aware of, it might be everything's off the table, or step up's okay and touching on the head's okay, but then you touch me here and then I'm going to reach out and bite you. So you don't take any of that for granted. And you use positive reinforcement training for literally every single thing you want to do with that bird and gradually develop it, show them that's for their own interest. And then eventually you'll have genuine trust where, yeah, wherever you put your hand near that bird, they wouldn't dream of biting you because they're friends with you and they trust you. And there's nothing you can do that is going to make them scared. And you can take that to the max level.
Yeah. And I love that you said all of that because I remember watching one of your videos where you mentioned that good behavior takes time. Sometimes it can take weeks, months, or years, but bad behavior can happen overnight, and good behavior does not happen overnight. So I love all of those points because it's just a reminder to everybody that you really need to put in the time and effort into educating yourself, learning your bird's body language, behavior, training techniques, understanding their species, their care requirements, and everything else that comes with parrots, but also
That's
using that
exactly
positive
right.
enforcement and understanding that good behavior and all of those things that we want to be seeing, it takes time to, see more of those good behaviors and rewarding them for those good behaviors because it's very easy for them to learn a bad behavior. As soon as they bite you and you scream or freak out, then they're like, wow, there's so much commotion. There's something happening. There's a reaction. And then they learn that every time I do this, every time I bite, or every time I chew your curtains, I get a reaction. And it's easy for them to learn that. But if we want to teach them the positive behaviors, that is something that takes time.
Exactly right. That's exactly right.
In another one of your videos, you said your bird can be a voluntary participant in the things that you want your bird to be a part of. And you also said, whatever it is that you want from your bird, make sure they're a voluntary participant and use the power of positive reinforcement training. And I loved that line, and it really stuck with me because I'm like, that's it. It's the power of that positive reinforcement and rewarding them. And over time, they're going to learn. I get the question all the time, like, how is Mia, this way with you? How can you hold her like an ice cream? And it's just over time, rewarding that positive behaviors and the behaviors that I wanted to keep seeing from her. And so, it didn't happen overnight.
And the my biggest advice on that aspect is to don't forget how long these parrots live. People love talking about
Yeah.
they live 50 to 100 years. They live for so long. It's not a sprint. It's a very long marathon. You've
Yeah.
got years and years to work on building your bond relationship, and you have to keep working on it. It doesn't. It's just like marriage or just like any relationship. You can't just give up on it and just stop. You have to keep working on it. It's a lifelong commitment. It's a lifelong effort to keep working at. So when you put that in perspective, it helps. I've had my parents up to 15 years, and the effort that I put in the first week, in the first month, the first year, and the first 5 years, and the first 10 years, the first 15 years, those efforts, keep paying off. And we have those bonds and relationships and things. So in what yes, when you just got that bird, what happens in the first day, in the first week, seems like such a big deal. Getting that bird on your hand as soon as possible. You want that bird on your hand in the first week. Chasing after that is going to set you back in the long run. Whereas doing things right, taking it slow, using the training, even if it takes a month or a year or 5 years to get to some of those goals that you have, hey, 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later, that bird's still with you, still alive, and doing those things, those efforts pay off. So that's why. Don't feel the rush. Take your time to work on these things and enjoy the process too.
Yeah. And speaking of their life expectancy, they can live like macaws can live like I think up to 80 years. And the life expectancy for like a conure is 25 to 30 years, especially in captivity. But in order for them to also live that full life expectancy, it's on us to make sure that they're also healthy and happy and enriched and have a good diet and regular avian vet checkups. What would be your advice to somebody to ensure that you're keeping your bird healthy? because we know that, you know, with birds, they also hide their illness really well and for as long as possible. And a lot of times when you start to see symptoms, you hear this a lot, that, you know, at that point, it's, you know, you're kind of in too deep. And sometimes it can be a little bit too late, not always. But it's really important to make sure that you're having those avian vet checkups and keeping their diet in check and so on.
Well, actually, the first thing that everyone should do as soon as possible is have a scale and weigh the bird every day. Having the scale is not enough. You got to use it every day. Big misconception. A lot of people only use that scale once a month or once a week. A lot of people, even vets, make the mistake of telling people to weigh their bird once a week.
That's what
not
I was told.
Helpful. So weighing the bird once a month or once a week is good for the upper weight. It's good to help you make sure that they don't get too obese and get too high in weight.
Right.
Only weighing them daily is going to help you save the day from being too low in weight. You see, it takes weeks and months for them to gain weight and become obese and overweight. And you might need a dietary adjustment if they're going overweight.
Yeah.
But that's a slow process. But dropping weight, when they get sick, when they get ill, injured, that weight starts dropping precipitously. And they'll be... Basically, usually it's about 3 to 5 days of drop before they're done. And doing, if you weigh them daily, you can start catching that and seeing a trend and getting the bird with the vet in time to try to get help. If you weigh the bird once a week, the bird could already start the drop the day after you weighed the bird and perish before the next weighing. So using that scale daily is the right answer. You don't have to do it more than once a day. Once a day is definitely enough. Weigh them in the morning. That's great.
Is it before breakfast is the best time to weigh them?
Yes, ideally in the morning after they poop, before they eat breakfast, then you can have a good consistent weight. We're not worried about the micro changes in weight. They pooped once, they ate a crop full of food. We're not worried about those micro changes in weight, but big unexpected changes in weight, sudden drops in weight, those are your big warning signs. And that's where the scale is going to save your bird's life, as opposed to alert you to the fact that your bird's eating a little bit too many Nutriberries and we need to cut it back. So weighing them once a week or once a month might help you on that long run trend. But for the short run trend, it's the drop in weight that's going to save the day. Realizing that the drop in weight is going to save the day. And The other thing that people don't realize, everyone starts thinking about illness, about the bird being sick. Birds, when they get injured, they also oftentimes have similar symptoms, similar signs as being ill. Very subtle, they try to hide it and all of that. But, you know, a lot of people think, oh, I don't take my bird anywhere. Oh, I don't, you know, there's no access to them to get sick from another bird. My bird's perfectly healthy. And that's fairly true. However, they can just simply have a night fright or fall down in their cage and bruise their ribs or, you know, bust a bone. You know, if it's like they broke their wing, that might be obvious. You might be able to see them shooting a wing and that might be a little more obvious, but they fell down and busted a rib or something a little bit more subtle, punctured an air sac or just injured an air sac, something that's not visible, something you don't realize. But seeing that drop in weight might alert you to the fact something's wrong. You can get them to a vet and they might be able to give them pain medication. They might be able to feed them if necessary. They might be able to fix the fracture. So don't take the scale. Don't think just about illness and just about weight tendency and food when it comes to the scale. But the scale might alert you to the fact that they're injured in a way that you might not have realized otherwise through that drop in weight.
Very interesting. That is really like great information. And I'm so glad that we touched on that topic because it is so important. And I know that weighing your bird is really important because a drop in weight can indicate you need to get to the vet as soon as possible and check out what's going on. But I love that you mentioned that it needs to be done every day because I think that a lot of the information online tells you that it's okay to do it once a week. And as you mentioned, you might weigh them and they might be fine. And the next day they might start dropping weight, but you're not going to catch that. So I love that you shared that. And on your website, you also have scales, bird scales, right?
That's awesome. Right. I've got new perch bird scales in two sizes. I've got a one size most for all small, medium, and large parrots. And I've got a mini that's reads in 0.1 gram increments. So you can weigh budgies and green cheek conures and cockatiels and the smallest birds and have that better accuracy for them, because for them a 1 gram difference is much more obvious. And those scales, they come with a new perch that's similar to the perches that I patented and make for the cage, for the trees, for the life, for the whole house, for the whole lifestyle. So if you put a new perch in the cage and a new perch on the training perch, that new perch, scale perch, is already familiar. You don't even have to spend any effort training the bird to go on the scale, because it's the same as the other perches that they're familiar with. They adapt to it almost instantaneously. So that's also part of my lifestyle approach, and using supplies by kind of using a series of bird furniture, using similar things throughout the home made from a similar perch. The bird can easily identify that that's a good place for a bird to go. It looks just like the one in my cage. I can go on that tree stand. I can go on that tabletop. I can go on that scale. I'm not afraid of it. So again, it's a way to help you train your bird, let them get used to the perch in their cage without you. They're learning to not be scared of the perch in their cage on their own time. So when you take them out of the cage and put them on the scale or on the tree stand, they're already familiar with it. So that's one of the ways that I like using supplies to shortcut some of the stuff. It's totally fine to have a completely different tree and a completely different tabletop, a completely different scale that look nothing like each other. And you can use your target stick and time to gradually get the bird comfortable with it and all that. And it's a great idea to do that. That's totally great. But having stuff that's more similar and familiar to the bird helps you shortcut some of that effort so that you can work on other behavior. You can work on other behavior that's maybe a little bit more helpful, and, you know, let the supplies help you out where possible.
Yeah. Awesome. I love it. I love it so much. I love all the things that we're chatting about, but I wanted to go back to species, because you are also the first person on the Parrot Podcast who has a Senegal parrot and Cape parrots. So I wanted to know a little bit more specifically about those species. And I also know that your Senegal Kili is famous for his tricks. He's been on the Steve Harvey Show, America's Got Talent, and David Letterman. Amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, I love the Bucephalus genus, and particularly Senegal parrots and capes. Senegal parrots are one of the best blends and kind of the hidden gem of the parrot world. They're definitely much more of a personality bird. They're not as sharp with their looks like a sun cranier or a scarlet macaw. They're definitely kind of on the overlooked. When you go to a bird store and you kind of choose between all the different species, they're not the one that stands out to you. Yeah. But their cool traits are that they're more quiet, and they're a big bird in a small body. So I know you hear that a lot, but, you know, there's some birds that are a small bird in a small body, and there's some big birds that act like they're in a small body, tall body birds that are in a big body. But Senegal are very much like a big bird in a small body. They're much more like an African gray than like a sun conure or something. So their behavior is more akin to what you see from some of the bigger birds, which is generally just a little bit slower moving, a little bit calmer, a little bit more talkative, a little bit more slow paced. And it's easier as humans relate to that. The smaller birds, you know, your budgies and cockatiels and even green cheeks, everything's very fast for them. They do 10 things in the amount of time it takes you to think of one thing. And that's one of the things that makes big parrots so appealing, is their body speed is slower, more akin to our time clock. Mm. It's easier for us to interact with them in real time rather than us trying to speed ourselves up to meet their clock.
Yeah.
And that's what's really cool about Senegals and Capes, is that they are the bigger bird in the smaller body, and very convenient for when you have a less space, you're in an apartment, you need less noise. The Senegal is quieter and smaller, which is very convenient for that. And they're very smart and very, very good at learning tricks. Kitty's learned all those tricks and been on all those TV shows with me. Just a very, very good blend of intelligence, size, and capability. And the capes, they're their own thing. They're quite similar to African grays. Unlike African grays, though, they're not powder birds. African grays are terrific, but they're powder birds, which can be a lot of trouble for some people with allergies and things like that, or even just the cleaning. So a cape parrot is kind of the diet version of a gray. They're not quite the same thing as a gray. They're not quite as good of a talker as a gray. But I will venture to say that I still consider capes a better talker than grays. And not in the default sense. The default sense is, yes, the African gray can learn more words, imitate the tone of voice much more clearly. They can talk in context. They've got a lot of this like amazing capability. I won't say that general, I mean, every bird's different, but I won't say that in general, capes talk better than grays. However, capes are much less shy. They're much more bold, much more outgoing. You're more likely to hear your cape parrot talk to you in person or talk for your friends than the gray. The gray will say 1,000 words sitting in its cage when you're not around. Nobody's around to hear it. The moment your friends come over and say, wow, you've got a talking parrot, I want to hear it, that bird is going to be a mute. That bird, you're going to be caught with your pants down, and nobody's going to believe you that your bird can say a word. Because that effing gray is very, very particular and picky about under what circumstances it's going to talk. And meanwhile, the cape will let off, might only know 10 words, but it's going to give you all 10 of them right in front of your friends. So in some ways, I would say that publicly speaking, cape parrot is a better talker than an African gray, because the African gray is going to stand you up every time.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing. And they're not pouter birds.
They're not pouter birds. They're more closely related to Senegals. So they're oil birds. So they're not dusty in the same way, but they can be pretty messy. They still make a fair amount of dust. But that's more like dander and the powder off the feathers and things like that, but it's not the powder birds. But unlike Senegals, capes can be quite loud. So I would say that between an African gray and a cape, African gray may be a quieter bird. So if you're looking for a quieter mid-sized bird, African grays generally speaking, broad terms, every bird's going to be different, but African grays will tend to be a little bit quieter, a little shyer. The cape's going to be a little bit bolder, a little bit noisier. So that's kind of choosing. If you're looking for those similar traits of mid-size and talkative, the gray is going to be more powdery and more quiet. The cape's going to be maybe a bit more chatty, but also noisier.
And how did you get each of your birds? I know that you inherited Rachel, your blue and gold, through your wife, or because your wife had her. And how did Keely and Truman and Cody come into your life?
Keely was my first long-term parrot that I still have. I got her from a bird store, didn't know anything. Naively, I picked her because of the three birds I held at the store, she was the only one that stayed on my finger. So naively, I thought, oh, okay, this bird must like me, and that's gonna be fine. And that wasn't really so much the case when we got home. That's why I started training and looked into training and discovered training is so important, because what you see at the store for a minute is not in any way representative of what's going to happen when they come home. Of course, it's very important to pick your bird and let your bird pick you. And that's still a very important aspect of it, but that does not mean the bird's going to behave when you get home. So the behavior is still something you got to work on. It's definitely picking is an important part of the process, but that's how I ended up with Keely. Truman, I got as a from a breeder, and he was supposed to be Keely's protege. He's named Truman after the Truman Show. And he goes, while the world he inhabits is in some respects counterfeit, there's nothing fake about Truman himself. No scripts, no cue cards. It isn't always Shakespeare, but it's genuine. It's a life. And the premise of the movie, The Truman Show, was that the guy was born in front of the camera and his whole life was televised. And that was kind of the idea of what I was going to do with Truman. And ironically, and I don't like the Truman and The Truman Show, it wasn't really his thing. He was never really into it. He was like the star and always wanted the attention. I thought if I raised Truman in the spotlight from the start, he'd be like that too. And he really turned out not to be like that. He's much more camera shy and more of a pet house bird than a performer and an outgoing bird. So it wasn't until he got lost that, you know, I just really, really reflected and realized that, you know what, if he didn't want that life, he can just be a pet, and, you know, we don't have to worry about that. You know, when he flew away, it just really, really dawned on me. And it was kind of like the Truman Show, where, you know, Truman escapes out of the real world. And that's kind of when I realized that, you know what, I'm so happy to have him back. He can just be a pet, and he doesn't have to participate like Keely always has.
Oh my gosh. When did he fly away? And how long was he missing for?
It was a while ago. It was probably about 10 years ago. I'm not going to get into it right now, but it's part of it. Part it it it, it led it was in very indirectly through a lot of things led to me meeting my future wife, and how everything else went. That's a whole different story you can read about on my blog. But I was free flying him outside, and going out. I knew it wasn't the right day. I knew it wasn't going to be good. But it was the first like beautiful spring day of the year, and I just really wanted to go get given the experience to do it. And I already knew going in that it wasn't quite right. He wasn't right in the right mood. And he didn't want to fly. He already gave me all the signs he didn't want to fly. But I made him fly because I'm like, let's do a couple of flights and we'll just go home. Like, let's make the most of it. I think that's the trap in free flight. That's why I'm not a fan of free flight for pet birds. No matter how good you are at it, no matter how good the bird is at it, we as humans have our own flaws. And sooner or later, it can be our fault that we lose them. And nobody's perfect, so everyone can make a mistake. But even if you could be perfect as a human, the bird can make a mistake. So things can go wrong. But I made him fly when he didn't want to. He took a lap of the park, and then he took one more lap of the park, and then he just flew out the gates of the park. Most ironic thing is he didn't fly over the fence of the park. There's the open gates. He flew at shoulder level through the gates to come out, because that's the flight level that I always taught him to fly at, was kind of lower, more human oriented. And then after that, he started down the street, and he was lost for it was 48 hours across 3 days, but it felt like a lifetime. And it punched me in the gut so hard, and I was so lost from that I realized that, you know, no matter how good you could be a free flight, even if it never happens again, it's not a chance I would ever want to take. And not a chance I'd want anyone else to ever take. So I've been just very strictly harness or aviary or travel cage only for everyone, because it's not something that you want to relive, let alone let the bird have to go through. So
absolutely.
I have nothing against free flight, but I don't believe that it's something that common pet owners, where it's your personal pet that you live with, should be doing or aspiring to. It can be a lot of fun watching those videos, and as long as people can watch them and enjoy them with a grain of salt, and say it's like watching the Discovery Channel. Like, you don't expect, just because you see a cheetah on the Discovery Channel, doesn't make you want to go out and have a cheetah or something. You don't expect that. So as long as you can watch free flight videos and see them in that light, that's terrific, and it's beautiful and solely fine. And if that's the sole focus that people want to do, that's fine. But I definitely want to caution pet owners from getting too carried away with what they see and trying it themselves, because it's too hard to lose your family member, beloved pet companion. So be safe. Use a harness, use a travel cage, use an aviary.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that story. I know that must have been hard, and I can't imagine how difficult it was when he was missing. So I'm so glad that you got him back and you got him home, and that is so many years behind you. But it does serve as a reminder to people, like, follow your gut and your intuition. Like, if you feel that something's not right or it might not go well, don't push past that feeling, because I feel like our intuition is always trying to tell us something and steer us in the right direction or guide us. And we also need to, like, listen to our bird's body language and the signs that they're giving us. And I know that that must have been a huge learning curve for you, and listening to that story, I know that it was. And I think that this is also a really good reminder for a lot of people that, like, sometimes just take their bird out, that haven't done any free flight training, that haven't done harness training, without a travel carrier or like a travel backpack. And you see this sometimes on social media all of the time, where they just take them out and they're hoping for the best. And you never know, like, something can spook them and they're gone. And a lot of times you might not be able to find them. There is a huge community online that, you know, a lot of times you can get people to help you and find your bird, but sometimes they might go missing, and it's just a heartache that we can avoid. So thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, exactly. And Rachel, that's happened to Rachel too. Before I even met Mariana, Rachel was lost in one of those ways. So the fact is that this happens left and right. And you need to listen to your intuition and gut when it's conservative, when it's telling you, you know, better not to do this. It's a good reason. It's a good reason to your gut. When you think it's a good idea, that's when you got to listen to your mind, because and don't jump so fast into that, because it seems fine. And the problem is, you see all the stuff online and it seems very encouraging. It seems like, you know, you only see the good parts. You don't usually see the bad parts. So you got to listen to people tell you to, you know, warn you about the bad parts. It does happen. And it's really outside of your control if you're going to be able to get that bird back or not after that. Some lucky stories, yes, and some definitely not so lucky. So definitely not worth taking that chance.
Yeah. And that's why we're here, to share the good stuff, but to also share the bad stuff and the real stuff. We'll start to wrap things up very soon, but since we're talking about, you know, all different types of parrots, I wanted to ask you, what is the biggest difference that you notice between large birds and small birds? Because I think this is something that comes up a lot. Like when people want a bird and they're trying to decide on a bird, sometimes they wonder like, what is a beginner bird? And I've gotten this question a lot, like, what is a beginner bird? And I don't really think that there is a beginner bird. Like there's no really such thing as a beginner bird, because every parrot is complex. Their care requirements are complex, and you really need to educate yourself on the specific species, but also on all of the requirements that they need. So to anybody who's listening, who's like, I want a bird, I can't decide on this species. What is your advice on beginner birds, or, you know, choosing a bird? And what is the biggest difference that you see between having small parrots and large parrots?
Well, absolutely. There actually is a thing, such a thing as a beginner bird. Absolutely. There is a beginner bird. It's the first bird that you get when you haven't had a bird before. Whatever your first bird that you're beginning your journey having parrots with is your beginner bird.
Yeah.
And it's going to be that bird, whichever one it ends up. So really the concept of, you know, what makes a good beginner bird is misleading, because they're all intelligent. They're all difficult. They all have their own specifics. So it's really not about what the species is. The truth is, the difference between a budgie and a macaw is smaller than the difference between any species of parrot and any other pet you can get. Because they're birds, they fly, they have feathers, they bite, they have a different mindset about how they go about things than your cat or dog or children. So the first thing is, you know, really deciding whether or not a parrot is even right for you at all. Any bird, do you really want the things that they are, the good, the bad, and the ugly? You know, it's a package, you get everything. Don't overly romanticize things you see online, because it's much easier to share the good stuff and the bad stuff. I have to talk about the bad stuff, because when the bad stuff is happening, it's out of the blue and I don't have a camera rolling. The good stuff happens when we deliberately set ourselves up to talk about something, show you a trick, you know, do something deliberate. That's rehearsed and practiced. We don't practice the bad stuff. The bad stuff just happens out of the blue. So inevitably, the bad stuff is highly underrepresented, or the bad stuff is things you're going to listen to people talk about, because they're going to recall the bad experiences. The good stuff is the stuff that's kind of easier to show. It's not even that we're sugarcoating it. It's just that it's easier to show the good stuff. And the bad stuff is something that takes a little effort to talk about. Now, when it comes to what bird to start with, I really don't think it matters about the species for what it's like getting started. It's much more about education. The fact is, the budgie or cockatiel is going to be still unlike any other pet you've ever had when it's your beginner bird, when it's your first bird. Whatever bird that is, whether it's a macaw or a budgie, is going to be unlike any experience you've had before.
Yeah.
And learning on the job, even though it's inevitable, the less we can depend on learning on the job, the better we can do. I think the concept between beginner bird and, you know, kind of your second bird is, you've made all those mistakes on your beginner bird. You make those mistakes and you learn your lessons, so that when you have your second bird, you try to do things right the second time around, not make those silly mistakes. Well, that's why I'm here as an educator. That's why this podcast, I'm sure, is here, is to, if we can upstream you making all your mistakes yourself and then trying to do it right the second time around, we want you to do it right the first time around.
Yeah.
So if I can upstream that and educate you and help provide you the tips and guidance so that you can do it right with your first bird the first time, you may not need or want a second bird. You may be perfectly content with your first one. You're going to get the max experience out of it. Then if you want another one, it would be solely just because you want another one and not because you're unhappy with the first one. And those mistakes, it's hard to teach the good stuff. It's very easy to teach the bad stuff. So Mistakes are easy to make. It's hard to undo them. So preventing making those mistakes to begin with is just really the key. So check out my book, The Parrot Wizard's Guide to Well-Behaved Parrots. That's really my most complete in one place source of kind of my full experience of life living with parrots successfully. And it's already in the second edition. So it's just very, very developed and thought through. If you're only to look at one thing, you read that book and then you pick the species that most appeals to you, you'll be able to do it. You want to take a little further to watch my YouTube videos. You can watch my Parrot Academy videos. You can get the supplies. That comes second, but the knowledge is the first thing. I would recommend anyone read the book before choosing any parrot species, and you'll have the confidence and the tools and the knowledge to get into whatever species most appeals to you. So I definitely don't recommend that somebody get a cockatiel when they want a macaw. They want a macaw and their dream bird is a macaw, and that's all they want is a macaw. I don't think anyone should talk you into getting a cockatiel so you can get some practice,
right,
and get your mistakes out of the way and then go get the macaw.
Yeah.
I suggest you spend a few months, read the book, watch a lot of videos, read about the species, learn all the bad things, because the good things are going to appeal to us. Like, we really attach the good things. Wow,
yeah.
That bird's so beautiful. That bird talks. That bird looks nice. You'll find the good stuff easily. I challenge you to find some of the bad stuff and figure out if you can tolerate it or not. Can you tolerate a train horn voice in the mornings? Can you tolerate, you know, every single feather on this bird is going to fall off and be around your house at some point. They molt, they replace their feathers. Are you going to be able to tolerate this many feathers being all over your house at some point, et cetera, et cetera? So I definitely would very strongly encourage you to learn the downsides, which are a little bit more hidden, probably not deliberately. I mean, I think some people might be sugarcoating. I think it's much more that it's not as much fun to talk about the downsides. It's not as obvious, not as out there. So I would challenge you to put the effort into learning some of the downsides. And then, you know, between your budget and lifestyle, you know, choose this that is most appropriate to you. And speaking of budget, if budget is a concern, and even if budget's not a concern, even if you just would like to work with an older bird, I also want to say that don't feel that you have to get a baby. You can totally get an adult. Budget is one of the primary reasons people would look into an adult initially, but there's lots of other good reasons. And if you read the book and you get the knowledge and you learn the downsides, you learn the difficult sides, and learn how to befriend and train them, you can do it. If you can do it with a baby, you can do it with an adult. It does not make or break. And in fact, a lot of babies, when they're not properly raised, when they are that beginner bird, they are the first person's first bird, and they make all their mistakes on that bird, you might get away with it while they're a baby, but as they grow into an adult, they turn into that same rescue bird, that same rehome bird you'd find from a third party or from a rescue. That baby turns into that rescue bird for the owner just the same. Whereas if you go and look at adult parrots, you go look at rescue parrots, you'll see them the way they are. You can see them kind of at their worst, you know, the least trusting of you, the least acceptable that they might be. And you can only get better from there. It's probably not going to get worse. When you meet a parrot that's an adult and it's biting and not stepping up, et cetera, and you can accept that that's the worst the bird's going to be. But if you put in all this effort, you're going to get better and better and get to the good stuff. You'll be totally happy. And it's going to be an all improving uphill, like constantly getting better and better situation for you. With a baby, when they're young enough, they're naive enough, you might get away with some things that you're not doing right, but you get away with it for a little while. And then they mature to that adult, and then you have those same problems all over again anyway. So I totally encourage anyone to get any species, any size, any age, based on doing the research, reading the information, learning in depth, learning the ups and downs, and being prepared for them, being ready for the worst that they're going to be, and then working toward the best that they can be.
Absolutely. I love all of those points. And I also loved that you mentioned, like, you need to learn about the bad stuff and see, like, what can you tolerate? And can you tolerate it for their life expectancy? Can you tolerate this for 25 years? Can you tolerate this for 50 years, for 60, for 80? So those are really all important things. And I'm glad that you mentioned all of those. On that topic, what do you find is the biggest difference between having a small bird and a large bird? Is it like the mess, or is it the noise, or is it their behaviors?
It's all of the above. It's all of that. The big birds are a big experience, and everything about them is big, particularly macaws. Their size is big. Their cage, their enclosure, the space they occupy is big. Their voice is big. Their presence is big. They make their presence known in that big way. So everything is big.
Yeah.
The little birds, everything's smaller. It's more scalable. Not to say that they're less important, but they can be a little bit less of a priority just because the cage is smaller, their voice is smaller, the space they occupy is smaller. So if you want to have the bird experience, but you don't want that bird experience to dominate your house and be like, you know, so obvious and in your face, that's totally cool to have a smaller bird. It could be because you're in an apartment or in a smaller home, because it could be because you have a big family. It could just be that you're curious about birds. You'd like to have a bird as a pet, but it's not the only pet or the only hobby that you want to have. You want to still do a lot of other things as well. It makes it, it's just easier. It's easier to get a big cage for a small bird, because a big cage for a small bird is still pretty small. When you get into the big birds, you have to substitute for a lot of that. You have to put for a lot of that because they're just so big, and they're inevitably going to kind of overwhelm the space and sound of your home. So that's definitely something to think about. So, you know, big isn't necessarily always better. There's a lot of reasons why, even with unrestricted budget and space, you might still well choose a smaller bird. There's a lot of good reasons for that. So really weigh kind of the experience of the size versus your home, and kind of how big of a presence that bird is to your home, particularly when you're not engaged with the bird. Okay, when you're engaged with the bird, that's all great and fun, but what about all the time you're not engaged? What about the time when you're having dinner? What about the time when you want to sit and watch TV? What about the time when you need to go to work? Think about how the size of that bird is going to, and the size of your home and household is going to, you know, play into each other. So that's where the size comes in. And then from the behavior, I talked about that earlier, kind of the bigger birds, it's the clock that's different. It's that everything happens slower. Things happen in slow motion. They walk slower. They fly slower. They learn slower. The little birds actually learn faster. If you're in a bit of a hurry and you want to accomplish things faster, the little birds learn faster. So the bigger birds, a little bit calmer, a little bit easier for us to keep at our pace. Little birds, a little bit more exciting, a little bit more high-paced. You got to kind of rush to keep up with them. But they're all terrific. I really love and appreciate all parrots. And that's really what I'm there with, is not a preference for any specific size or species, but really share the lifestyle and harmony that you can achieve with all species of parrots.
Yeah, we love all parrots too. I have one more question, and then I have a couple of questions if you have time from some listeners. But my last question in regards to all different types of parrots is, if you have different size parrots or different species at home, or you have one type of species, say you have a conure and you want to get a macaw, or you want to get an African gray, a bigger size bird, and you have a smaller size bird, or vice versa, what is your advice or opinion on having different size parrots together?
Basically, unless you have two parrots of the same species, particularly species that get along, that are more flock oriented and get along with each other, never assume that any of them will ever get along or that they're safe together.
Yeah.
If they are, that's a bonus. That's, you know, the cherry on top. But you need to start out with the presumption that they will not be compatible with each other, and you must keep them separate. That you're going to have two lives now. Instead of having one parrot, you're going to have one cage and one parrot, one cage and another parrot, one out of cage time for one, separate out of cage time for the other. And if you can blend it and make it work more together, that's a bonus. But don't think that, oh, you know, I'll just let both out together, so I'll still be able to spend the same amount of time, but just I'll have it with two parrots. That may not work. So you have to go in assuming it won't work. And if you can afford the time and the space to keep them entirely separate, if they do get along together or you can trust them out together, that's a terrific bonus, but I would not count on it. The size difference, the beak difference, and the way they handle each other is different. They come from different continents, they may well come from different continents or different countries.
Yeah.
They're not naturally inclined to associate with other birds of different sizes or species.
Yeah, that's something that I sometimes see online is when there's like a bigger bird with a smaller bird, and then the smaller bird sustains some kind of inner injuries, like a missing toe or a bit beak, because you have to also make sure that you're supervising those interactions. But I think it's important to know your birds and know if they interact well with one another, because you don't want something to happen to one bird or another. I don't know. Like when I see, for example, a small conure or a budgie with a macaw, I feel like that would make me nervous.
Well, you know what though? Don't just worry about the size. Even within the same size of the same species, female budgies will beat up the male budgies. You could have a little cage with 5 or 10 budgies in it, and one of them could get injured or hurt. So you got to
Yeah,
be careful.
that's true too.
It's not even just the size. You got to know about the species, the temperament, how they get along with others. Basically, start with the presumption that you're going to keep everything separate and give them everything. Double everything. Don't even think that like you have a tree stand, you're just gonna have two birds, and that's share the tree stand. Two birds, you have twice the birds, twice the tree stands, twice everything,
Yeah.
and it's only a bonus if they get along together. So I've definitely played safe and start with that presumption and not get involved in more birds if you don't have the time and space to have more of everything for them to be able to do it separately.
Yeah. Before we jump into the questions from listeners, I also wanted to ask because we talked about this a lot, and I know you've got Cody and you had those three baby African greys. What is it like to have baby birds? And I'm sure that people are also wondering, how do you ensure proper development and nutrition and care for a growing baby bird?
That's a whole other topic, but
Top three tips.
I particularly focus on their behavior and development mentally as well as physically. So physically, it's very important that they fledge, that they learn to fly, that they learn to fly in the environment. Letting them
Yeah.
fledge in an aviary or in something like that, unless that's what you expect to keep them in, is not best either. Letting them fledge and develop in the type of environment they're going to live. And of course, home to home, things might be different, but if they're going to live in a home where the rooms and windows and things like that, that's where they need to grow up and develop at that young age, because then they really learn how to fly in certain vent windows and mirrors and all that. So being able
Yeah.
to develop in an environment that's representative of the kind of environment they're going to spend their life in is very, very important. Nutritionally, they need to develop. The most important thing nutritionally is not what they eat for now. You can always fix the diet and they can improve that later and it'll be okay. The short term, spending 6 months or a few years of eating something bad and then eating something good later is not the problem. Problem is that their habits form. So developing healthy habits, the healthy food early, and eating a wide variety of food will help them to still be happy and choosing to eat healthy later on. So developing healthy eating habits early and behavioral, again, if they're raised with not just the environment, but raised with the behavior and the handling and kind of style that they're going to spend their life with is super beneficial. So just basically raising them in a loving, nurturing way that's representative of their long-term lifestyle is by far the best way. And then they don't know anything else. They're not missing out. If you don't let them grow up in the wild, we're not dealing with wild caught parents. We're not snatching parents from the wild and depriving them of that lifestyle they're used to. We're raising baby parrots into the lifestyle that they're going to have. It's the only life they know. They're happy with it because it's what they grew up with. It's the lifestyle that they are familiar with and enjoy. Then we can actually enhance their lives with it rather than, depreciate it. So for sure, raising them for the lifestyle that they're going to have can lead them to be very happy, with being in that lifestyle for the long run.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that about baby birds. And I'm going to jump into some questions that we have from listeners that I thought would be really great to chat with you about. So since we're on this topic, then I think that we'll start with this question. Someone said, Hey, hope you're doing good. I have a question. When you have one bird, should birds not go in pairs, or can you keep them alone when they are out of the cage for like half the day or a lot of the time?
You really want to think about what's conducive to your lifestyle, how much of a companion you can be to your bird. Knowing that they're social animals, they definitely
Yeah.
crave and desire interaction with others. And if you're able to provide that and you're able to provide consistent quality out of cage time, interaction, handling, and be that for them. Having the single bird gives you the best opportunity to be as much of that in their relationship as possible. You're going to get more of that in reciprocated as well. If, however, you feel like you're more busy, you want to help them be more self-engaged, self-sustained, then another flock mate of the same species or possibly even a different species in a cage that's near them that they can still interact with and see each other, talk to each other, can help them be a little bit more self-sufficient, and both are okay. It really comes down to the lifestyle that you're able to provide.
Awesome. I also think that it's important to note that when you do get another bird or you want to grow your flock, it doesn't always mean that they're going to like each other and they're going to become best friends or they're going to become companions or mates.
Yep.
And so that's something that you also have to be prepared for, because we can't choose their friends. Just like nobody chooses our friends for us, we choose our own friends. It would be the same for our birds.
I'm just going to add that generally when you're involved with the smaller ones, budgies, cockatiels, green cheeks, you're much more likely that they will be friends. It's not guaranteed, but as you get from there, it's actually more likely that they won't be friends and that it's not going to help. So the bigger they get, the more choosy in particular they might be. So with the smaller birds, a pair of budgies or a pair of lovebirds, a pair of cockatiels, quite likely to be a success and not guaranteed, but quite likely. But as you get to the bigger birds, you really want to think twice if you want to get involved in that, because that can be quite tricky.
All right. The next question was, I've been told not to have two conures or you will lose the bond with it. Is it possible to have two and still keep your bond?
So kind of the default is, particularly with those smaller birds, they're much more likely to bond with other small birds. You are quite likely to lose the bond and you're going to have to put in more work. So first of all, you got to put in quite a bit of work to have that in the first place, but because they don't have another bird, you're getting the advantage and opportunity of the fact that they are displacing some of the bond they would have had for another bird to you. That advantage, which allows you to put in slightly less work than if you have two. Now, if you have two and they do bond to each other, it's still possible. You're going to have to work a lot harder to overcome that. So unless you're prepared to make a lot more effort and work into it, it will, of course, be easier, much more likely to reciprocate and, you know, get their social interaction and fun out of the day from you rather than from another bird. It's much harder to overcome the fact when they have beaks and they're the same size and they're the same shape. It's much easier for them to interact in the right way with each other, to preen each other, and to provide the optimal companionship for each other. Your companionship is a good substitute when they don't have another bird, but when they do, it's possible. It's going to be a lot harder because they'll have a more familiar friendship from another bird.
Awesome. The next question was, we are trying for a baby, but I'm literally worried that the bird is going to literally hate the child. Any tips?
I'm guessing that you're trying for a human baby rather than another baby.
Yeah, a human baby.
But I parents live for such a long time that we may well go through our lives with them in our lives. We will go through being single, you know, having a significant other, to getting married, to having a baby, to that baby being a child, to that baby going to college, to back to being just with you again. That bird can well live through all those different phases of your life. Everything's going to change. So just any aspect like that is not a reason to give up on the bird, not a reason to give up the bird, not a reason to rehome the bird. These things are going to change. You know, yes, there's going to be a few years when you have an infant and it's super, super, you know, time consuming, and maybe your attention might be more than on the bird during that time. But then guess what? A few years later, the child goes to school and you might have more time to kind of rekindle and redo more with the bird again. So that time and, you know, interaction will inevitably change as the changes happen in our life. You get a new job and you got to devote more time to it. You have a long vacation, you have more time to spend with the bird. It's going to change, you know, week to week and year to year and over decades, these things are going to change. So my biggest advice is to really bond and train and build a great relationship, develop the supplies and lifestyle when you don't have the baby, when you do have more time to dedicate with your bird, because working on teaching the bird and training the bird and getting to all of that stuff when you're super involved with the baby is going to be just too overwhelming. So get ahead, Do all that stuff now, whether you think you need it or not. Get ahead on training and developing a great lifestyle with the bird, but also teach the bird independence. Don't make the bird too dependent on you ahead of time either. Balance teaching them to be have a good relationship with you so that when you're more busy and you don't have time to teach them new things, they still know those things from the past. But at the same time, teach them to forage and play with toys and stay self-occupied. And then, during that period, there might be a period when you're not as available, but then you'll be more available again later. And so that's perfectly fine. Now, about hating the baby or being aggressive or attacking the baby, it's definitely not something we want to chance. And they can have developed jealousy and rivalry toward others. And it's much easier to control guests, to tell guests, well, hold your hand like this, do that. With a baby, you can't really do that. So I generally recommend physical separation. Keep the bird in a different room or in the cage when the baby, don't have them interact with each other. It won't be long until the child is 3, 4, or 5 years old and can listen to your direction. The bird can listen to your direction, and you can help them develop interaction together in
In a
a
relationship.
cognitive, deliberate way. It's just a few years that you might want to keep them apart, not let the bird get jealous and have that kind of rivalry.
Or do maybe like gradual, slow introductions, or like from a distance, or if the bird's like in the cage, you can bring the baby in so that it can get used to the new human's presence.
Yeah,
Great
for sure.
advice. Great
Yeah, for
advice.
sure. Ah!
All right, two more of these questions. This one I thought was really great to ask you because I've seen that you've done videos on this. And this person asked how to train a bird to get their nails trimmed and how often. So I guess like when would you know that it's time to get the bird's nails trimmed and how would you do it or go about getting them trimmed?
That's a great question. So first and foremost, when they're making too much ouchie on your hand, that's the time to get them trimmed because we don't want to be uncomfortable. We don't want to not be picking up our bird, not handling them because they hurt us with their nails too much. That's first and foremost. Or the other reason would be if they get overgrown and they're getting too long, then they might need a trim. The first and easiest thing to do is, again, when I always like to talk about using supplies to shortcut the behavior, is to use a grooming perch. Not excessively. Don't put it as their sleeping perch. Put it lower in their cage. Put it by their food or water, so they go on it a little bit each day, but not all the time. That will help make a nail trim last longer. It's very rare that I've seen a bird not be sharp and like never need nail trims just from a grooming perch. It's not quite enough. However, it'll make a nail trim last easily twice or three times longer. It'll make a nail trim last three or four months rather than 1 or 2 months, maybe a few weeks. So grooming perch will definitely help on that. But when it comes to doing it yourself,
While we're on
I've
this
got.
topic, I also wanted to mention I also use a grooming perch. I just put it in a spot where it's like a short-term perching spot. Like I wouldn't put it in like a long-term perching spot, like where she sleeps or something like that. And I find that it does make those nail trims work that much longer. And I also saw that you have a perch where it's soft on the top so that they don't develop things like bumblefoot, and it's coarse on the bottom so it's filing their nails. So if you're listening, theparrotwizard.com, and you can get that perch.
Right, exactly. And it's also shaped like new perches, so it's more familiar, it's more textured and bumpy. Definitely helps. Now, when it comes to nail trimming, I don't particularly recommend cutting with scissors or using a Dremel or the more advanced techniques. That is better left to expert. Go to a veterinarian or a groomer. Let someone who's a little bit more experienced do that because it's easy to overdo it. It's easy to cause bleeding. It's easy to harm the bird by doing it incorrectly. So I don't teach people how to do that themselves. If you want to learn to do it yourself, go see a professional do it so that you can learn in person on your bird how it's done. However, a nail trimmer, this is a Paired Wizard nail trimmer stone, is something that anyone can do because you can't overdo it. You can't make your bird's nails bleed with this or not make them bleed much. At most, you could get a tiny little drop and it'll stop on its own. You don't even have to do anything to stop the blood. But you're not going to file that hard because if you do the voluntary nail trim the way I teach people to do it, the bird's going to let you know before you do too much. You teach them how to get comfortable letting you hold the foot, touch the foot, file the nail, and they'll do that for treats. But eventually, when it's actually about to reach the blood, reach the quick, they'll still fidget and say like, enough's enough, I don't want any more. And they'll actually tell you, you don't have to do anything. They'll tell you. So, Rachel, can I have your foot? Rachel, can you come give me your foot? Thank you. So she'll come give me her foot and we can practice a little bit and we can do it. The beautiful thing about doing it yourself this way with the voluntary nail trim is it's no stress on the bird, no chance of them catching a disease because you bring them to a groomer that's seeing lots and lots of birds. They just saw a sick bird right before your bird. Much less stressful. And there's nothing to say that you have to do all the nails in one shot. When you tend to a groomer, it's kind of harsh, fast, forceful, and they got to do all eight all in one shot. When you do it yourself, you could do two nails a day. You could do one nail a day. You could do half a nail a day. Nobody says you have to take it all the way down to short. You could do a little today and a little more tomorrow, and you make it part of your daily routine. And there's no stress when the bird comes and participates and does it themselves. Here, can I get this one? We can do the back toe here.
Wow, Rachel, you're such a great sport.
There we go. Good job. So you can find more videos about that on All Parrots YouTube and the nail trimmers available at parrotwizard.com. Cool thing about this one is it's a stone. You can hear that. It's oops. So it's hard. And unlike a paper nail file is okay. You can use it on the bird, but when they bite on it, sometimes they'll bite on it, they'll just shred the paper. Or the parrot's nails are tougher than our human nails. So being flat and hard gives you some resistance that you're working against. Whereas when you use the paper one, it's great on our nails because our nails are contoured, our nails are round. So we like the paper one on us because we can bend it around the nails. The bird's nails, we're trying to file them into a blunt, straight cut rather than making any rounding, because any rounding is going to make them sharper again. It'll make them shorter, but sharper. So having a straight nail file that's hard and stiff like this helps you get that blunter, straighter cut, and it's just wash and it's reusable.
Yeah, awesome. I have to get myself one of those because I've always used the ones that you kind of just buy at the store, like for nails, like the paper ones. But I like that one a lot better. And that's a great tip. Thank you. Okay, one more question. Does anyone know how to deal with the poop? My boy just won't cooperate with potty training. Do I give up and just accept my fate? What's your opinion on potty training? Because I did see that the Avian Online Association did a post about how potty training might not be the best. And I'm gonna maybe read that after, but first I'm gonna get your opinion on potty training or, like with birds. They poop every 15 to 20 minutes. It's just a thing with birds. You have to accept the fact that they are messy, they are noisy, and they poop a lot and they poop everywhere. So there is possibility of potty training them, but I'm not entirely sure if that's the best route.
Yeah, for sure. That's all correct. And this is why my particular focus is really on supplies and timing when it comes to the supplies. By having convenient stands, having a tree stand with a base that's easy to clean, having a training perch with a tray where they poop on the tray and you can pick it up. By setting up supplies where you're not going to be upset and it's going to be easier to clean is by far the best way, because they don't spend most of their time flying. I mean, even if they fly a bunch, they fly from stand to stands. If you put up two or three stands in your home, even the little guys that fly around a lot, they'll land on the stand and they'll there, and you put a newspaper there and you just collect it. So if that bothers you, then yeah, the bird's not going to work out for you. But as long as you are just trying to basically have them not everywhere in your house and not all over you, that's where it's totally doable without even potty training. First, the supplies, put them on stands where they can, where you're content cleaning it up, where it's easy to clean up from. And then about being on you, on your person, you should never have a bird on you long enough to poop on you. And that's for two reasons. The poop is only half the reason. So first of all, you should be putting them down at a regular basis, 10, 15 minutes, so that they could poop on their stand and not on you. But second of all, also so that they don't become overly attached and bonded to you. If you got a bird riding your shoulder for an hour, 2, 3 hours at a time, not only is your back going to be covered in poop, they're not going to want to come off your shoulder. They'll be happy to spend all day there. But when it comes time to take them off, they're going to at best bite your finger, or worse, whoops, at worst, you're going to be doing this trying to get them off the back of your neck where they're going to find the one spot where you can't get them, right? So it's good to take them off on a regular basis and break things up for a little bit. Not let them get so really attached to us, because then when we go to work or we have something else going on, they get very upset about it. So putting them down on a regular basis helps deal with the poop, but it also helps with the behavior. Put them down, to give them a treat, give them a toy to play with, and then pick them up again and do a little bit of hands-on interaction, and then put them on a different stand, and then put them in the cage, and then later take them out. You know, by mixing around where you put them, where you interact with them, will help them be bonded with you, but not over bonded with you, where they get to the point where they become needy. And the byproduct is the poop is taken care of. So that is really that's the thing that keeps 99% of the poop off of me. And that 1% accident here and there where it happens, you just clean it up and, you know, accept that. But frankly, I don't get pooped on really hardly any. And I haven't been potty training my birds lately. I did that initially, and over time I kind of let it dissipate, and the lifestyle approach is all it takes. But by the way, it's probably one of the best reasons not to clip their wings is my parrots, when they need a poop, they fly off me, go back to their stands and poop there. When you clip their wings, or if they're handicapped and can't fly, you got to make sure you're putting them down regularly so you don't get pooped on. But over time, when you build this routine deliberately, you know, you do it for a few months or years where you always put them down ahead of time when they need, before they need a poop, so they don't poop on you.
Yeah.
Before you know it, they fly off themselves and you don't even have to do the work. So yeah, the one thing you don't want to do, you don't want to be giving them treats for pooping. That's where it can lead to trouble. And that's the one thing not to do.
Yeah, because they had posted here that when a bird receives a reward for defecating on command or at the right spot, they might start pushing more or harder just to get a reward. In extreme cases, this could even lead to cloacal prolapse. I don't know if I said that right. Another issue that could occur when the owner is away and someone else takes care of the bird might not understand when and where it is allowed to defecate.
Exactly. So, we don't want to ever be that strict. It's more about just timing and having good places for them to go. Biggest mistake, though, is not having some specific stands meant for birds. That's where they're going to be pooping on your furniture because they don't have any other choice. So
yeah,
having stuff that's made for birds and that's comfy for birds will help keep it off of the places that we don't want to be cleaning it out of.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. We're going to wrap things up. I'm so excited about this whole episode. Thank you so much for everything that you've shared. I'm going to ask some funny questions before we go. If your parents could attend school, what subjects do you think each of them would do well in?
I don't know, probably a physical education. They're all very athletic. They love to fly and get around, so that's probably their favorite.
And if your parents were to start a business, what type of business do you think that they would run?
Well, you know how they have like kissing booths? Maybe they'd make a biting booth, you know, selling bird bites. I mean, they're not biting birds, but I think that that's when I think of parrots in general, I think like I could totally see a kissing booth where they sucker you in. You know those cockatoos where
yeah.
at rescue where they say, "I love you, I love you," and they're sticking their foot out, and the moment you come up to them, they'll like pull you in and bite you. So I just see that snarkiness from parrots where they're just like that.
I love it. Instead of a kissing booth, it's a biting booth. If your parrots were superheroes, what powers do you think each one of them would have?
I think they're already superheroes. They can fly. Can you do that?
Yeah, that's true. All right. If your parents were chefs, what do you think that they would prepare? What kind of dish?
Oh, my birds are big foodies. They're definitely big into all the kind of produce and fresh stuff. And I'm sure they'd be making some terrific, you know, vegetarian, vegan specialties. So they're definitely into all of that kind of stuff.
Awesome. All right. One more. If your parents could go on vacation, what destination do you think that they would choose?
They're kind of homebodies, so I don't really see them particularly going anywhere, but who can complain about a tropical destination like Tahiti? Or something, even though there's no parrots in some of those places, or Hawaii or Tahiti, there's no natural parrots there, but yet they always have the souvenirs of a parrot,
yeah.
you know, in a armchair with the sign Tahiti or Hawaii on it. So for some reason, we really associate our parrots lounging with a cocktail on one of those tropical islands that parrots don't really come from.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It was so awesome to have you on the Parrot Podcast.
I sure hope so. I hope your audience can get some entertainment, some knowledge, some guidance, and but also, feel that they're not alone, that there's a community that, even though these parents are so wonderful and amazing, they can also be challenging. And I hope
Yeah.
that they can find hope and solace that, if other people can do it and there's information out there that they can do it too. There's no reason to feel like you can't do it. You totally can do it. You totally can get a parrot of your dreams. You can totally befriend them and build trust and have a great relationship. It's the effort that you're going to put in. If you're motivated and you want to do it, go for it. They're amazing animals, and I love them.
Yeah, we love them too. And I think that, like the things that we share on social media, like about all of the bad stuff and all of the good stuff, also kind of prepares people. But it's also nice for people to hear like the stories of like when we first got our birds, we weren't perfect, parrot owners, and we were learning too, and we've made mistakes. Because I think that people tend to beat themselves up a lot when they make a mistake or they didn't do all of the right things from the beginning or with their first bird. And, I love all the conversations that we had today because it also reminds people that we weren't perfect either. We've made mistakes, and we're also sharing as much as we can so that people can learn through our mistakes and not have to make those mistakes, as you mentioned, like with their first bird, and then do it right with their second bird. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Parrot Podcast. I'm your host, Sandra, from Poodles and Parrots. I hope that you enjoyed this episode as much as me and Mia did, because we sure learned a lot from the Parrot Wizard, and we hope that you did too. Oh, and one more thing. This podcast is presented solely for educational and entertainment purposes. I'm not a licensed avian vet, behaviorist, or professional expert in parrots. The information provided is not intended as a substitute for professional advice from a qualified avian vet, trainer, or behaviorist. Please consult with a specialist for personalized guidance on your specific situation. Something that we didn't notice when we were opening the aviator harness when we were chatting with Michael is that this was inside of the packaging. So there you go, parrotwizard.com. What does it say here? Visit parrotwizard.com to explore how your loving commitment to your feathered companion plus a little help from the Parrot Wizard can lead to a truly magical parrot keeping experience. So yeah, amazing.